Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to ModPath Chat, the official podcast of Modern Pathology, featuring interviews with authors and experts on the latest science, technology, and developments in the field of pathology. Your host, Dr. George Netto, is the editor-in-chief of Modern Pathology and the chair of pathology at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Here's Dr. Netto.
Thank you for tuning in to a special Meet the Expert episode of our podcast. I'm honored to be joined by two distinguished guests from Johns Hopkins University who will discuss with us their pioneering approach of applying methodologies that was initially developed for astronomy to the assessment of biomarkers of tumor microenvironment, or TME. My guest is Dr. Janice Taube, Director of Dermatopathology at Hopkins and a co-director of the TME Core at the Bloomberg Kimmel Institute of Immunotherapy. But also joining me is, you know what? I want to repeat that because I should have said my guests are. I'm used to say, so we'll start all over. Thank you for tuning in to a special Meet the Expert episode of our podcast. I'm honored to be joined by two distinguished guests from Johns Hopkins University who will discuss with us their pioneering approach of applying methodologies that was initially developed for astronomy to the assessment of biomarkers of tumor microenvironment, or let's call it TME. My guests are Dr. Janice Taube, Director of Dermatopathology at Hopkins and a co-director of the TME Core at the Bloomberg Kimmel Institute of Immunotherapy. Also joining me is Dr. Alex Solai, a Bloomberg Distinguished Professor of Astronomy and Computer Science at Hopkins. Alex is the architect for the science archives of Sloan Digital Sky Survey. If our audience are wondering why are we having a pathologist and an astronomer as our guests, the answer is what's called AstroPath. Hopefully you'll hear a lot about that. So AstroPath is a platform that our guests co-developed and was recently featured in The Economist magazine. Now, it's great that pathology is making it to The Economist. That tells you we're really high tech and we're really important. So thank you, Janice and Alex, for accepting my invitation.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
It's really a pleasure. I'm very excited and about this discussion about what really is hopefully going to take us into the next level. I know image analysis and digital paths is the third revolution in pathology, but this is even a step beyond. So, Alex, I know you spent a couple of decades doing the survey for the Digital Sky Survey, the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. If you can share with our audience, maybe in 2 to 3 minutes, what is this about? And so we can set up the stage.
So the Sloan Digital Sky Survey started it at the same time, roughly, as the Human Genome Project. So the digital technology, digital imaging technology, which is also at the heart of genomics and now of digital pathology, just became kind of technically and financially available for science. And so they started all in 1992. And the idea was to build a digital telescope, so which didn't have photographic plates, which was the kind of run-of-the-mill imaging device then. So, but build a big digital camera and build a special telescope to house this in New Mexico in the US, and then do survey the whole sky instead of just pointing, taking a pointed observation of a small part of the sky. And the idea was to build everything in 4 years and then continue the survey and be done by the year 2000. As it turned out, we were too optimistic, and it all really started only in 2001. And then it went on until about 2018. And now it's continuing with a different instrument on the telescope. But we collected an enormous amount of data. We sometimes try to call it the Cosmic Genome Project. Uh-huh. And the whole idea was to collect all these images of the sky, then actually do very deep pointed observations of taking spectra of the closest million galaxies and make all the data immediately available for everyone to see, but in a very nice calibrated form. And we created a shrink wrap database around it that everybody can log in and essentially do virtual observations of the sky, you know, rain or shine, and day and night, anytime. And we have at this point about 7 million different people who have looked at our data, which is amazing since there are only about 15,000 professional astronomers all over the world.
7 million. So,
but the digital word is really very important here in the name of the survey. And I think what happened really is that during these 20 years that we have been building and operating this, we saw a lot of patterns, how people started to use the data, but also patterns in what we had to do to actually automate the whole survey, the data processing, and so on. And then once we were kind of done, it became very interesting that all these patterns that we learned, how can we turn it into process? How can we apply it in other scientific disciplines? And it turns out that when I met Janice and we started to talk about the challenges they are facing, it really became obvious that there are enormous similarities in what we have been doing. So we took large images of the sky and built an all-sky mosaic out of it in multiple colors. This is like doing the multiplex imaging in the cancer imaging. So, and then we segmented the images, broke it up into stars and galaxies. This is like the cells on the images. And then we were studying the spatial relations.
So among the stars and
galaxies, and now we are doing the spatial relations. So in a sense, I'm doing just all the same things I've been
and
doing.
And you can do all that without any pathology training. You just bypassed 10 years worth of stuff that Janice had to invest. Yeah. Well, that's what collaboration is all about. So amazing. So the term cosmic genome, is that before you met Janice, you thought of that name or after?
Yeah, so we kind of jokingly called ourselves. So to try to somehow convey the kind of the scope and the magnitude of the enterprise.
Excellent. Well, wonderful. So thank you for that description. Janice, I know the proof of principle publication that you just put out in Science, I think it was the June issue of this year, Science, about using this technology and this platform to specifically to melanoma cohort and as your interest is in immune therapy and markers of predicting response, that was a great cohort to apply it to. So can you share with us what some of the challenges and that you tackled as you're starting to apply this star era technology to your microscope images?
Yeah, I think that a lot of the challenges were there before. And in fact, the AstroPath platform was the way that we were trying to answer some of those challenges. The multiplex technologies put multiple markers on a slide, and we are working at about 6 to 8 markers per slide. There's definitely technologies out there that claim to be able to do 40 to 70. And really what AstroPath meant to us was an end-to-end platform that was very rigorously validated and standardized. So we wanted to make sure, even from the start, that when we were staining, that it was the equivalent of what we would get in clinical practice and that it was reproducible. So for example, as you mentioned, we're very interested in immunotherapy and predicting outcomes to anti-PD-1 and PD-L1. So those were two of the markers that we put in our panel. And we ensured that the PD-L1 that we were detecting as a part of our multiplex assay was the same that you would get if you had used a single chromogenic companion diagnostic. And I think that's what everybody assumes is happening, but in fact, it's not the case. And if we had used three agents off the shelf as if they were marketed, we would have lost 50% of our PD-L1 signal. So, you know, we did a lot of optimizations with marker order and staining and understanding the fluorophores and how they interacted with each other to be able to develop this robust panel. The next thing we did, and again, I think this is also really informed by me being a diagnostic pathologist, is that a lot of the multiplexing technologies look at single high-powered fields. So you're sampling about 1/100th of the information on a slide. And with Alex's help, as he described, we were able to tile the entire slide and capture, you know, numerous high-powered fields and really generate tumor immune maps with high fidelity single cell resolution. And it was really once we had generated those very accurate maps that we were able to ask all of the scientific questions that we wanted to ask within that context. So first we mapped all the tumors, and then we did, if you will, the true experiments on the data after the data had already been generated.
And data, I mean, oh, if I'm mentioning correctly, 127,400 images just in this study, 100 million cells were captured, because you're doing it at the cell level, multidimensional, multispectral at the cell level. So around trillions of pixels just for this 98 cases of melanoma with 6 markers, right? So Alex, how one can process all this? What is...
Well, it's only computer. It's only computers.
So it must be a powerful computer.
Well, surprisingly, well, Moore's law comes to the rescue. You know, so when we started out with the Sky Survey, computers were slow, and then basically every 18 months, the performance of computers doubled. The price of the disks have dropped by a factor of 2. So this is why we can do all these things that we couldn't have dreamt about this 20 years ago. But today it's actually quite easy. So it's more the software that becomes the bottleneck. The computing hardware is becoming really disposable, the commodity in science. And really writing the code is becoming the more difficult thing.
And I guess we benefited from the 18 years of reiterations of improvements that we did.
Yeah, and you know, one thing that we learned in astronomy, that why doing the Sky Survey with its 500 million galaxies was that essentially we could discover, and we have discovered, incredibly rare phenomena that we didn't even know that existed before. So once you have 1,000 objects, in order to say with confidence that something is there, you have to have hundreds of it. But that's really only 10% of 1,000. So we could only, with 1,000 objects, you can look only at rare objects which are 10% rare. With 100 million objects, you can look at objects which are, you know, 10,000 objects are still very significant.
It struck me in reading the piece in The Economist that you quoting you, you said already with you're doing three types of tumors, being a melanoma and lung, non-small lung cancer, and Merkel cell, I believe, that you already, some of the images and the data, it's almost a third of in the amount of what you've been doing for the Sky survey.
I think already we surpassed the Sky survey's pixels, the number of pixels.
Wow.
I was amazed when I actually counted up.
That's a lot of pixels.
Yes. Lots of pixels. So, almost 10 trillion pixels.
Oh, my God. Go ahead.
Alex's point about a rare event, that was one of the fun findings of our study is we found a rare cell type, a CD8 cell that's also FOXP3 positive. And the function of this cell had not been previously well described. Historically, people had thought that it might be a suppressor T cell. And more recently, there had been reports suggesting it might be an effector T cell. And we were able to identify that with certainty in our large data sets. And it's actually a killer T cell, and not a regulatory T cell. And we found this unexpected combination of markers that was actually the most highly predictive feature of response to immunotherapy. And then we were able to turn around and go back and localize it right to the tumor stromal border in such a way that substantiated our hypothesis about its function. In conjunction with collaborators, we were also able to look at some single cell data. But it is a real rare cell type, and we wouldn't have been able to find it without having the large data volumes that we had and know that it was a real signal and not just noise.
So you were able to find that rare star or rare incidence of these cells. Were you able, when you mentioned look at the cell level, you mean lift them, do transcriptomic, and because I know your platform is capable of that, to identify those cells and do further analysis?
Yeah, we didn't actually. We used a pre-existing single-cell data set that one of our collaborators, Drew Pardoll, had and asked him to do some computational work on it. But I think the fun thing was Drew had always anticipated that their single cell data would inform the markers that we then validated in protein on AstroPath. And for us, this was great because we were the ones who had identified this previously unappreciated biology, even with just the six markers that we were looking at, not the thousands of markers that people typically think of with single cell. And it was Drew who went back to his data and actually validated our finding. And they had discarded that because it had been such a rare finding. They weren't sure and they thought it was noise. But together, we were able to substantiate the work and potentiate each other's science.
So then again, this was a proof of principle. You guys want to take it to 20 to 30 multiplex markers, and I'm sure that's going to lead to even identifying other biomarkers or combinations or rare cells, rare interactions that are important and informative. How do you see this? Because I know the ultimate aim for you, Janice, is can we transform this into a standardized test that all of us, or at least reference laboratories, and not everyone has Dr. Zalai in their team, and all the computational power. How do you see that transition, and how long far ahead are we going to have to wait for that?
Well, the work that we have done already as shows a highly predictive biomarker for patients with melanoma receiving anti-PD-1 based therapies. And it would be possible, I believe, within the next 3 to 5 years to have a commercial version of that assay move to clinic. But to your bigger question about what happens next, how do we handle these 30 markers? I think what we are really in the phase of right now is data generation and curation. And what we're going to want to do is look at all of these markers and then distill them down to the key ones that are orthogonal to each other. I don't think our vision or that we anticipate that we'll need 30 markers to predict. Hopefully. The question is just what are the best 6 or 7 or 8 that are out there? And then we'll be able to design an assay around that. And I think that more comprehensive question, I would put more on the 5 to 8 year timeline. We have a specific focus on pan-tumor signatures as well. So we're really trying to reach across tumor types, but it also increases the time and the number of cases that we'll need to look at.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Excellent. So you think we're going to be locked into, if you develop on 6, 7 markers, and we're going to be locked into the immunofluorescence, or can this go back to chromogenic staining, or what is your expectation?
I had anticipated that we would in fact be able to reduce our findings back down to chromogenic, but one of the key things that we showed in AstroPath was our ability to robustly measure marker intensity in situ. So you can think of it as doing flow cytometry on tissue. So rather than just looking at, is a cell PD-1 positive or negative, you can say, is it expressing PD-1 at low, mid, or high levels? And that actually has important biological import. It connotes a different functional state of those T cells, and they have different biomarker potentials. And in fact, we found those that express PD-1 at low and mid to be much more highly predictive of response than those that express PD-1 at high levels. And so, one, this answers a question of PD-1 protein is, of course, the target of many of these agents. And we had wondered why PD-1 densities alone didn't necessarily predict response. This is one of the potential answers to that. But it does get to your question of, can we take our findings and reduce it back to chromogenic? If you do that, you lose your dynamic range and that intensity value. So there is added value of being able to do intensity. And there will be specific use cases where I think we want to maintain immunofluorescence. episodes. I think there will be others where we can probably go back to chromogenic and run those readily, but intensity does add value.
Yeah, I mean, specifically in those rare cells, you mentioned the CD8 positive, FOXP positive, and they were like then low or mid for PD-1, and that we would have not been able to do with multiplexing of any different three colors on chromogen, right?
So, yeah.
Well, fascinating. And so, Alex, what's next? How do you see this project evolving? And what other, I know you're still working on the Sky Survey, the digital Sky Survey. Yeah. What you see, can it help us in other things beside image analysis of our scopes?
Well, so first of all, so we are trying to work very actively into our way into spatial transcriptomics. So how can we combine spatial genomic data with this, which may provide, you know, some insight if we can assign the spatial information to the genomic information after under each bead in the spatial transcriptomics. There are probably 100 cells, a mixture of 100 cells. So the genomic signal is a superposition of the contribution of all those cells. And if we collect enough data, maybe we can statistically decompose into individual components, which may tell us about additional proteins that are expressed, which are part of the regulatory process. And then we can try to, so this will, genomics will always be too expensive to scale out on a massive scale what we are doing with imaging. And this might kind of guide us, you know, that what additional staining should Janice discover. And so hand in hand, kind of we kind of leapfrog on step by step onto each to find actually new stains and then get new biological insight on a massive scale.
Excellent. Janice, you touched on that, and that should be our last question is, you mentioned that selecting which high power field, the strategy that this thing the AstroPath can help you with. So because it's whole slide, right? And you're scanning and you're tiling up all it, what do you have anything to say about that? I mean, is it a small number of high power fields that we can substitute, or we're going to have to do it on whole slides? And because as you can imagine, that decreases the need for computational power if we can substitute the right high power fields to the correct ones.
Yeah, well, I think biomarker development and technology development are really moving ahead hand in hand. And there's definitely emerging technologies and some multiplexing platforms that are moving to whole slide imaging that are going to be computationally lighter than what we had been using originally. What we did as a part of this study was to acquire the whole slide, but to do it in discrete image tiles. And then that allowed us to ask, is there added value diagnostically in terms of which areas of the slide you sample? So I know many of the listeners are familiar with Jerome Gallon and the Immunoscore project. And in colorectal cancer, they deliberately sample from the central and the peripheral edge of the tumor. And there are some other groups who suggest that looking at the immune hotspots is what you really need to look for. So, you know, Sutton's law, you rob the bank because that's where the money is, right? And so we looked at these different sampling strategies. And what we found, and especially because of the CD8 FOXP3 rare cell that we're talking about, is that the biggest diagnostic advantage was when we'd acquired all of the slide, ranked these fields by CD8 density, and took the top 30% of the slides of those fields. And that's where we got the biggest diagnostic discriminating power between who was going to respond and who wasn't going to respond. The other important thing about how we did this, it was, again, all done computationally. So pathologists now, as they're choosing these fields, do it manually, and it's user dependent, even with the best intentions. And here there's a computer that's selecting the high power fields for you. And so it should be highly reproducible, no matter what institution you are and what machine you're using. And so I think that's a big step forward in terms of moving these into clinical care.
Thank you very much. It's been really an exciting and fascinating discussion. I'm so happy that we got the opportunity to do this, and I thank you both and look forward to hearing about your other discoveries soon. And hopefully some of them can be submitted to Modern Pathology, Janice.
Absolutely. Thank you. It's a pleasure. We've had a blast working together, and it's fun to share it with others.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the invitation.
Any opinions expressed in this podcast are the speaker's own and do not represent the views of Modern Pathology, Springer Nature, UAB, or USCAP. Your ModPath Chat host and scientific director is Dr. George Netto. Producers are Christina Crow, Amber Jackson, Dr. Sarah Jang, and Dr. Catherine Ketchum. Technical direction is provided by Kaminsky Productions, music by Mitch Neubauer. Thanks to the authors, reviewers, and editors of Modern Pathology for making this podcast possible.